It's All Things Considered on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Writer James Agee died in 1955, but the rediscovery of his work continues today. This month, in fact, the University of Tennessee Press will release new collections reflecting on Agee's work as a critic and journalist. Tuesday evening, Professor Michael LaFaro will lead a discussion about Agee's nonfiction work as part of UT's Conversations and Cocktails series. LaFaro says while Agee is widely known for his novels, his book and film reviews are also well worth examining.
Well, it's one of the largest actual bodies of his work, because he was a journalist off and on, but mostly on for a good bit of his life. The reviews are what I'm focusing on for this particular talk, and it covers a period of 20 years of his short life. He died when he was 45. So from 1927, literally picking up one high school review, to 1947, both in terms of book reviews and film reviews. The book reviews have been published for the first time by Professor Emeritus Paul Ashdown here at UT. Journalism professor did a fine job with his volume of Agee's journalism, and the film reviews will soon be coming out by another UT professor, Charles Mayland, in the English department, and they should be out, in fact, later this month. It's both are large volumes. Many of these volumes approach 1,000 pages. They're scholarly volumes, but Agee's work is designed in those volumes to be read by the interested reader.
What do we learn when we read those critical reviews of books and films from this very interesting period in Hollywood and in American literature? What do we learn about James Agee from reading his writings?
We certainly learn that there's a quest for authenticity. He's a great believer in realistic depiction. That's how he first got to know John Huston, by praising literally a war film of John Huston's, The Battle of San Pietro. And Huston was so taken by it, that's because Agee's one of the first people critically to actually evaluate his work. And he said, the guy got it. He knew what I was trying to do. And so they met later at Huston's invitation, and that eventually led to Agee doing the screenplay for The African Queen with John Huston. So there's a lot with Agee that goes on, and you're right, completely. The breadth of what he has done really is unknown to most people, because they focus on what their favorite is, and that's perfectly fine, too. But this is a man who literally exploited almost every field of writing imaginable.
And as you mentioned, in a very short period of his life, Mr. Agee died in 1955, a year that, to many of the people who are listening to this conversation, may as well have taken place in ancient Greece. 55, what a long time ago, at least in terms of a human lifespan in our culture, which has moved in light speed since then. What do you think is the relevance or significance of James Agee's critical work to somebody reading today? You mentioned these volumes that are coming out that are designed to be read by readers now in 2017. What is the relevance that I might get out of it if I read this today?
Well, depending on what you pick up, you might find that Agee, besides being a fantastic writer of prose and also of poetry, his words force you to search yourself. He is so much the self-examiner in all of his work that you are forced to do the same thing. And he relates to basic issues of humanity. He is not necessarily focusing on a specific time period where if you don't have the context, you don't get it. Because the work is semi-autobiographical, whether it's the loss of his father, the plight of sharecroppers in Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, or a young boy trying to come to terms with religion in The Morning Watched to talk about his three prose works that were autobiographical in nature to a great deal, he always manages to reveal a huge amount about himself, but more importantly, I think, about the way we should inquire about ourselves and our relationship to our times.
I submit that there is a difference between being a writer who is born in the South and being a Southern writer. When I think of Southern writers, and of course you're a professor of English, you know a lot more about this than I do, but I would think of a group that is tied together or put into boundaries by maybe a common style or by subject matter. And I would think of people like Harper Lee or Flannery O'Connor or William Faulkner and many others. A.G. was from the South, he was from Knoxville, but he did a lot of his work in New York City and in other places. He did venture down to Alabama during the Depression at the behest of the federal government to write about the lives of the sharecroppers during the Depression. Which was A.G.? Was he a Southern writer, or was he a writer who was from the South?
Yes.
I like that answer.
He is indeed both. A lot of his self-inquiry into just his own identity, he never questioned that he was a Southerner. And I think it was accentuated because of his time mainly in New York and Los Angeles. Those major metropolitan centers made him feel his identity even more strongly. He also sometimes makes a distinction between being Appalachian and Southern, and sometimes conflates them. He doesn't necessarily make a choice, but he'll sometimes say, I'm Southern to the core. And also, he said, my people are mountain people. So it's one of the issues, in fact, in his identity search that he never really reconciled. But I don't think he saw it as something that needed reconciliation. For him, it was one and the same. We didn't really have a huge emphasis upon Appalachian-ness in his lifetime.
That is something, by the way, that is a common thread throughout Mr. A.G.'s life. His works were not particularly commercially successful, but have since gained much more appreciation since that time. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's certainly in part the stereotype of the romantic writer who is discovered only after his death.
And his tragically short life.
And a tragically short life indeed. But I think part of the issue was it was just not getting out. And with the revision and publication of A Death in the Family 2 years after his death, and it receiving the Pulitzer Prize, that kind of led to a renaissance, even a surge, of publication and republication of A.G. materials. Let Us Now Praise Famous Men flopped in 1941. It came out just not too long before Pearl Harbor. Yep. And people's minds were not on experimental fiction and prose at that particular point. But when it was reissued in 1960, it took off. It became literally a mainstay of the civil rights movement, of the human rights movement, and it's never been out of print since 1960.
It's interesting, as I listen to the way you talk about James A.G. and his work, there's an enthusiasm, quite palpably so, in your voice. I get that you're not just talking about James A.G. because it's your job or because that's a serious thing to do, but because you genuinely enjoy it. What do you enjoy about studying and talking about James A.G.'s work?
Well, I enjoy it because, frankly, of the beauty of the writing and the thought-provoking nature. I mean, sometimes he's a little too full of himself, but sometimes he's sheer genius. So it's that almost roller coaster effect he has, and most of the time he errs at least on the entertaining side, particularly in his career as a reviewer. Because again, you have his elite works, which is kind of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, when he is artful at his most artfulness. And then after that, there's a huge push, it's somewhat gradual, but to reach a wider and wider public audience. But a lot of what he did was anonymous reviews, for example, for Time and for, excuse me, The Nation and other pretty interesting, broad-based and widely read publications. Many people may not know, for example, he did the lead article for Time right after the dropping of the atomic bomb. And it is an incredible piece that is written. It's unsigned because all Time articles are unsigned. But the beauty and power and the thoughtfulness that go into his writing are certainly what intrigues me the most and makes me eager to share it with others.
As I'm thinking about James A.G.'s journalistic work, we're hearing elements of like a narrative-driven journalism, an experimental kind of form of journalism, something that's going to be much more engaging and I guess sort of grabs you by the lapels more than just an inverted pyramid, sort of, here's what happened today in the news. He's writing a story. And when I think about that, I think of like the new journalists like Tom Wolfe or Hunter S. Thompson. Is there any connection, or is there some way to look at it that James Agee was sort of the progenitor of that, or connected in some way?
In fact, that's one of the articles that's coming out in January in a book of essays about James Agee, his relationship to the new journalism. And he is clearly a progenitor of it because it's personal, it's edgy, and it's opinionated.
And could be polarizing. I mean, it could be
very much so. I mean, yeah. Agee, especially, I mean, not all his works were published in his own lifetime, but many of them would provoke discussion today. Even in a movie review that he did, it was a movie based on a book about homosexuality. And he said only in Hollywood could they turn a book on homosexuality into a movie on anti-Semitism. Homosexuality will have to wait. So he would take on all kinds of topics. He took on literally civil rights before it was really termed that as a subject.
Right, right.
And worked heavily with that. And one of his most appealing pieces to me was one that never was published. And it was after the Detroit race riots in 1943 and his own personal experience with racism on a New York City crosstown bus as he was going to Walker Evans's apartment. And what came out from it, he was on the bus with Southern sailors and they were drunk. It was World War II, and they were berating blacks. Mm. And the fact that they were on a bus with blacks was just fuel for their drunkenness. And Agee was sitting there, and he figured he could punch one of them and knock him out. But clearly, they were younger, stronger, and many of them, and he was going to get pummeled, and he didn't know what to do. He said he looked across him. There was another man across him who was looking very nervous, and clearly they shared their opinion. And then an older black woman, a grandmother, he said, basically, why are you boys doing this to people who's never done anything to you? And she manages to quell that. But he is so guilty about not having done anything when he reaches Walker Evans's, and everybody says, oh, yeah, you couldn't really have done anything. Yeah, you did the right thing by staying. There's nothing you could have done to make this situation other than you getting hurt any better. And he said, that didn't sit well with me. And then the last line is, that's why I'm telling it to you. It won an award as one of the best pieces when it came out. We found it and published it as one of the best stories of that year because it is so powerful. But it's personal, it's edgy, and it goes right to the core of your question. It's part of that new journalism. And what prompted it was his view of the publications of pictures of these race riots in which people were killed, both white and black.
Professor Michael LaFaro will be leading what I'm sure will be a fascinating discussion as part of the series Conversations and Cocktails, Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. at Holly's Gourmet Market in Bearden, focusing on James Agee's critical works. It's called James Agee Reviews the South. Dr. LaFaro, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been fun.